Spring into action with the biggest fly fishing gear sale of the season. Jackson Hole Fly Company is thrilled to announce their spectacular 25% off anniversary sale. They are inviting all of us to celebrate with them. Whether you're a seasoned angler or just starting out, there's never been a better time to upgrade your equipment and save big. Are you looking for a rugged, waterproof sling pack or backpack to keep your gear dry throughout all the adventures this year? They have you covered. Are you in search of a new carbon fiber landing net? Top quality fly boxes, essential gear like fly lines and leaders? They have all that and more. This is your chance to grab some incredible deals and make the fishing season unforgettable. Don't wait. Dive into the savings today. Head over to jacksonholeflycompany.com and take advantage of this limited time sale. Coming up next on the Wet Fly Swing podcast.
You know, I've seen plenty of them landed in there. You know, they're an amazing fish. They're just, they're hard to get a hook set on. And then they're one of the strongest fish I've ever fished for in fresh water. So once you've got it on, they're a big wide bodied fish. They get in the current and, you know, they're famous for getting under snags or around rocks. And like I said, for whatever reason, it's just never worked out for me. I've definitely had the fortune of hooking quite a few of them and everything else.
That was lane four on the magic of the Payara, Ecuador, Columbia flyouts, and vampire fish today on the swing.
Welcome to the Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show, where you discover tips, tricks, and tools from the leading names in fly fishing today.
Hey, how's it going today? Thanks for stopping by the show. Super easy way to support this podcast is by sharing out an episode. If you have a favorite in the past or one you've listened to recently, you can click down in your app and click that share button. It's usually a couple of clicks that gets it out there. Copy it over and share the love. Thanks in advance if you had a chance to share the podcast. Today's episode is sponsored by Range Meal Bars. Each bar is 700 calories and fits easily into the pocket of your backpack, vest, or wherever you need. Range bars are made using only the highest quality gluten-free ingredients, and they are the most convenient and compact way to get out the door and on the river. You can support this podcast and a great local company right now by heading over to wetflyswing.com/range. That's R-A-N-G-E. Range Meal Bars, a legitimate meal in your pocket. Today's episode is sponsored by Daiichi Fishing Hooks, a leader in the fly fishing industry and still the world's sharpest hook. Tempered with carbon-rich steel, Daiichi offers superior penetration without compromising the hook's structural integrity. You can head over right now to wetflyswing.com/Daiichi and check out what they have going and check out these killer hooks. That's Daiichi, D-A-I-I-C-H-I. Lane 4 is here to take us into Colombia and Ecuador and describes how to catch peacock bass on the fly. We hear about how he found himself setting up this program in this part of the world and how you might put together a trip in this remote area of your own. We also get into a little bit on the lodges, why they are hard to find and what makes this area so remote and unique. We dig into it all today. This is a wild journey, so let's find out how Lane is making it happen. Here we go. Lane 4. How's it going, Lane?
It's all good. Good. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Thanks. Thanks for coming on here. We're going to dig into a little bit on, South America, essentially, kind of the north tip of South America. And we're going to talk about Colombia and probably a little on Ecuador, peacock bass, and what you have going down there. And this is a part of the world that's, that isn't the place that we, you know, all, probably everybody's focus. It might not be on everybody's bucket list, but we're going to talk about why that might change here. So, before we get into all that, take us back to how you got into fly fishing really quick.
Okay. So I am originally from the Northeast, grew up outside of Boston. And yeah, just on the coast, summer times were about the water, the ocean. So fishing and sailing and everything in between. And then wasn't really a fly fisherman growing up. I did try it a couple times. It was sort of around, but you know, in the sort of early to mid 90s, it wasn't that popular. Fly fishing the salt. And unless you had a family member that was into it or something like that, it wasn't something that everybody did. So more grew up a bait fisherman and a gear fisherman. And then went out to university in American West, Colorado. And that's where I picked it up. That's where fly fishing sort of became my hobby of choice. And just kind of fell into it, got really lucky. Working at a fly shop in Boulder. It's no longer around, but it was called Liggus Flies. And Wally Allen, the owner, was, you know, just took me under his wing and, you know, showed me how to fish and how to tie flies and the whole spectrum of stuff out there. So that's how I got into it. And then I've been, you know, a pretty addicted fly fisherman ever since. You know, following wherever I'm going, I usually travel with the fly rod and try to figure something out along the way.
Right. What's your fly rod of choice to travel? Like, what's your travel rod when you're just kind of going somewhere you have no idea what you're going to get into?
Usually a 7-weight. That's sort of a, you know, a good all around rod. You know, if you want to fish the salt or the fresh or anything like that, it's pretty universal. So
7-weight. Yeah. What's it? Do you have a brand specifically you like?
I don't really, you know, I don't have any brand associations or anything like that, but I fish a TFO a lot, just because it's an easy rod. It's pretty lightweight. Yeah,
it's a good rod.
Then I've also got I've got a slew of rods, but I've got, you know, some Scott rods, some Sage rods, stuff like that. But the TFO seems to be the one that makes it into my bag more often than everything else.
Yeah. Nice. So after the, you know, the fly shop, like kind of going, getting addicted to it, when did the South America or how'd you get down south?
Yeah. So long story short, my wife is from Ecuador. We met at work about 17 years ago now. And one thing led to another, you know, we started dating, came down here to visit. And I was like, wow, this place is amazing. And then just as everything developed, we decided to settle down here, instead of in the States where I'm from. And, it's been about 15 years that I've been down here now, and just love it.
Full time?
Sort of. It's not that long of a story, but I've been a marine engineer for the past 15 years, working on boats and traveling a lot. So the way the marine industry works is you work rotationally. I've been doing 2 months at sea and then 2 months at home, pretty consistently throughout the years, with some bigger breaks off of boats and dedicating time down here. But, this has been home base, Quito, Ecuador for that whole time.
Gotcha. What's the town? You're in Ecuador. That's where you're are now.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm in Quito, the capital.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Up here in the mountains, beautiful, beautiful town. And the surrounding area is just stunning, you know?
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah. We had, Greg, a buddy of mine, we did at Ecuador kind of a little bit. He's not a fisherman, but we just kind of went into the space. He's out there. He's probably, he may have run across him out there. He's living out kind of in the jungle part of the time on the beach. And then we had another episode with Javier. We did, that was kind of Ecuador. There's, I guess, you know, we talked about the lodge. There's some lodge, I guess this is one of the lodges there. I'll put links to the show notes to those episodes as well. What's the boat? I'm kind of interested in that. Just kind of quickly on the marine engineering. What have you, I mean, boats, like, were you working on like massive boats, any crazy boats? What's that look like?
I was on private yachts.
Yachts. Okay.
So, I guess it's all relative, but yeah, some pretty big ones recently. You know, the yachting world has gone a little bit crazy. And so yachts have got incredibly large, incredibly fast. So the most recent boats have been in the 90 meter range, so 300 feet.
Wow.
Big crews and small numbers of guests. So super, super high end tourism. Both private and charter.
Gotcha. Someone wants to go out and just, if you got enough money to go out and get your own 300 foot sailboat, yacht, like it's not sailboat, yacht, that this is where you could go to one of these.
Yeah. It's a pretty elite group of people that can actually afford this sort of stuff. But it's a fairly, you know, fairly big business in certain parts of the world. You know, the Caribbean, there's a lot of yachting. South Florida, there's a lot. Mediterranean, there's a lot. And then recently, you know, because the boats are getting bigger and people want to see more of the world, they're becoming a lot more widespread. So I've been lucky enough to travel a lot of the world, not the whole world, with the caveat that, you know, you're working. So you do get to see stuff, you do get to experience it, but a lot of it is through the porthole or through the window.
Gotcha. Yeah. So you hop on a boat and you're just basically getting the thing, making sure it's ship shape, and then you hop off and they drop you off.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, we do get some time in certain areas, and depends on the schedule of the boat, depends on the program, but you do get to experience a lot, which is one of the benefits of the job.
Gotcha. God. Yeah. I can imagine, again, I'm kind of fantasizing about, you know, future trips, but I can imagine, hopping here in a boat, a sailboat would actually be pretty cool, you know, and, but whatever, and travel down, you know, like, let's head to South America and drop into Colombia or Ecuador. What would that, I mean, would that be a pretty, if people were, you know, would that be a doable thing? People are kind of taking a boat down and hopping in and doing some fishing. You ever see that?
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely a doable thing. It's really not that common at this point, but people do come down to this part of the world. The Galapagos obviously is a huge destination for cruising. It's a protected area, and there's a lot of regulations around what you can do and how you can fish and everything. So you do have to fish with locals and on local boats and everything there, but there's lots of people that do it. Colombia is not too much of a destination for yachts, but some boats have started getting more adventurous and cruising that part of the world. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's definitely a thing. Like I said, it's not that common at this point, but it's just a question of, you know, when people get that itch to go see something new and somewhere that people haven't been.
Exactly. And that's why we're here. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
That's why I thought this was, interesting to chat with you, because Colombia and Ecuador, both these places. I mean, what is the, if you look around there, obviously, yeah, the Galapagos, that's huge. Just around that area of kind of South America, Central America, where is the most popular destination that, say, the fly anglers would be coming into within a few, whatever countries in that area?
Yeah, I'd say at this point, between Ecuador and Colombia, Colombia for sure is a more popular destination.
Oh, Colombia is more popular.
Yeah. Yeah. As far as, fishing and fly fishing is concerned, there's a handful of operations that operate out of Colombia. It's sort of got a pretty good tradition with sport fishing, more nationally than internationally. There's a lot of, Colombians that are big fishermen, not necessarily fly fishermen, you know, gear fishermen, but they're big into it. And, there's a lot of camps that operate in the eastern part of the country. Here in Ecuador, there's really not the culture for it. You know, the Ecuadorians, for the most part, aren't really fishermen. There's a small community here that's really strong, but there hasn't been too much of it historically, and there hasn't been virtually any tourism here, where Colombia, there's been a lot more. Central America, I'm not too aware of. You know, I know Costa Rica is big, and I think there's some operations in Panama and stuff.
Yep.
But yeah, Colombia is definitely the more popular destination in this part of South America.
Gotcha. So there are some lodges and all that over there in Colombia?
Yeah, there's a few lodges. What I'm doing and the people that I'm working with, they run remote camps. So it's the same idea as a lodge. It's just, you know, it's not quite as permanent a structure. They're built up every season on the, you know, on the side of a river. And then taken down at the end of the season, very low impact.
Just like an Alaska camp, same sort of thing.
Same idea. Yeah, exactly. Same idea.
Gotcha. So that's the stuff. And we're going to dig into that today, I think, is my thought was, is how do we kind of, show people what Colombia looks like, maybe talk a little peacock bass. And then, it sounds like a pretty amazing trip. Let's just start there. Where is the starting point if somebody, you know, wanted to put something like this together? You know, are they booking, you know, talking to you, or are there other places? What's that look like?
Yeah. So, like I said, there's a few operations in Colombia. You know, there's some local Colombians that operate on a really high level. There's some, international people from the States and from Europe that, you know, act as hosts a lot, like what I'm doing there. So there's quite a few options. But all trips, you know, are generally arranged beforehand. There's not really a whole lot of DIY stuff in that part of the world. You can do it, but it's, you know, it's very difficult. I've done some of it myself as far as scouting, and it's pretty it's pretty tricky. So,
yeah.
You know, we operate, like I said, through existing camps, and all of the logistics for us and for most of the operations start and stop in Bogota, the capital. Mm-hmm. And then typically it's a fly out from Bogota to one of a couple towns on the sort of the Orinoco drainage. And then from there, you know, there's various ways, either overland or by boat to the camps. And yeah, the camp that I'm working with is a, indigenous owned and operated camp, which is, pretty unique in this part of the world. They're very much a sort of star in that sense. They're doing an amazing job of, operating, at a high level, you know, as far as tourism goes, and they have done it for the most part on their own initiative. The community there, they kind of started it with one particular member of the community, a little bit more connected to the whole tourism world. So he put it together and then got a lot of help from different operators in Colombia to get the thing going and get clients in. And I was lucky enough to visit there last year. I wasn't the first fly fisherman there, but one of the first. There hasn't been too many fly fishermen that have been to this part of Colombia. And yeah, this year we're running a trip in January, and it's the first fly only group there, so that'll be pretty cool. It's an amazing trip. Like I said, the logistics are, you know, it's not the easiest trip in the world. You got to get to Bogota, and then later take a short flight. It's only about 90 minutes to where we're going. We fly into Puerto Nirida, and then it's from there, same day, a 5 to 6 hour boat ride upriver to the camp.
Oh, gotcha, to the camp.
Yeah.
And now, is this, what does this look like if we were talking, or what are you guys going to be in January? What are you going to be fishing for? What are the species?
Peacocks. Peacocks are the main focus of this camp, but we also have piata, or also known as vampire fish, you know, the big toothy ones that you've seen pictures of, I'm sure. And then in the river, there's a bunch of different species. There's some catfish, there's some brycon species, a lot of little stuff. But the main attraction at this camp is the peacock bass. This river is called Caño Bocón. And it's a dark water river, much like the Rio Negro in Brazil. And it's just the perfect habitat for peacocks, and they get really, really big. Some of the biggest fish ever caught, on traditional tackle have come out of this river, you know, as far as world records go and things like that. You know, you need to be fishing in a specific way and have certified scales and everything else for those to be recorded. But, there's been some fish pushing the 30 pound mark that have been caught in this river. So it's a very unique place. It's very special. It's out there. Like I said, the logistics aren't the easiest to get out there, but it's a pretty comfortable trip, and the fishing is just amazing.
Yeah, and it doesn't sound too much more difficult. I mean, I'm sure it is a little bit, but say again, the Alaska comparison, you know, you fly into Anchorage and then you fly out to some other area, right, and hop in a boat. A lot of times the same thing. I mean, here, Bogota, fly out, you know, and then take a whatever 5 hour boat ride or something, which is definitely a long tour. Well, what's that look like? So when you fly out, you drop in to the city and then you're getting ready to that boat ride. Take us there. How does that feel? Is that a pretty nice boat ride?
Yeah. I mean, it's,
did you say five, was it 5 hours, 6 hours?
Yeah. 5 or 6 hours. You know, it depends on how loaded the boats are. You know, if they're completely full of gear and people, or if they're a little bit less, you know, they can go a little bit faster, but yeah, it's a good 5 to 6 hours. It's a long ride, but especially for the first time people in this part of the world, it's an amazing ride because you're cruising down a tributary of the Orinoco River. And you've got just unbelievable scenery all around you, you know, jungle.
How do you spell that? Orinoco?
So Orinoco, Orinoco.
Oh yeah. Perfect. Perfect. Good. So yeah, and it does sound cool. So you're cruising up this river, probably haven't seen a lot of these things. I mean, what are you seeing along, like, wildlife and plants and stuff along the way?
It's, you know, so the first part of the trip, in this particular trip, it's a big river. It's called the Inirida River, and it's, to put a guess, I don't know, 200 to 300 yards wide. You know, it's a big, big river. So, in the river, you know, you can see dolphins, you could see, you know, different types of fish. And then the bird life is pretty amazing. As you get up into Canyobocong, and continue up the river, it gets a lot smaller. And there you start to see a lot more, you know, a lot more wildlife, a lot more birds. You know, when you're cruising, going pretty fast and the motors are making a lot of noise,
yeah,
you know, you don't
scaring everything.
Yeah, you do see some stuff, but you tend to see the tail end of it, you know, as it's running away.
Right. Gotcha.
But there is a lot of stuff. And just being in the jungle, you know, that environment's it's amazing, especially for people that haven't been there. You know, it's just wild. You know, you've got the whole feeling of the heat, the humidity. You know, the people that you're with, the indigenous guides and everything, it's a very, very different dynamic.
Yeah.
And so it's a really cool trip. You know, 5 hours in a boat is 5 hours in a boat. The boats are comfortable. You know, there's cushion seats and everything else. But yeah, it's, you know, they're the same boats you fish out of. So they're open, aluminum style John boats with a Ripon 40 two-stroke Yamaha on the back. So it's a loud ride. You know, you're going fast, but you know, it's part of it. It's how you get to these camps. So
yeah, it's part of the experience.
Exactly.
And then when you roll into the camp, what's that look like once you get there? That'll be on, typically, is this like a week long trip?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a 7 day trip. 5.5 days of fishing. And then, you know, you've got the other sort of day and a half that is logistics on either end of it. And yeah, rolling into the camp, they're very nice tents, pitched on a sand beach, each tent, you know, one tent per angler, and you've got beds with mattresses in, a little nightstand, a fan, a lamp. So it's more like a glamping setup than anything else.
Yeah, it's glamping. Yeah.
And then above the tents, you've got, you know, a thatched roof, to keep the rain off.
Oh, right.
And everything else. And, yeah, then there's a sort of a dining area, relaxing area. And then there's the camp staff. They've got their sort of quarters and the kitchen, and everything is set up behind all of it. But yeah, it's, you know, it kind of comes out of nowhere. As you're cruising up the river, there's a few communities in the lower stretch of the river. And then where we're going, you pass one last community that on the way to camp, you typically stop at and just,
yeah,
you know, pick up anything that needs to be picked up last minute from the community, and you can get out and if you want to walk around, or there's always souvenirs to buy and things like that.
Oh, right.
And then, you know, you shoot up river and there's literally nothing. And then suddenly you come around a bend and there's this beautiful camp set up on the bank on a big white sand beach. So it's a pretty,
just roll in.
Yeah, it's a pretty, pretty unique experience.
Yeah. What are the, like safety wise, like just, is there anything to be thinking about? It's interesting because, you know, like we did a Florida episode recently and our guest was talking about how the alligators, right? He watched, ate somebody's dog and stuff like that. But, you know, so wherever you go, you're always going to have something. What are the safety? Because Colombia, I guess people right away probably think, you know, yeah, is there some areas where you got to be worried about stuff?
Yeah. I mean, Colombia, you know, it's got the reputation it does for a reason, because, you know, 20, 30 years ago, there was definitely some dangers, and there's still some dangers in certain parts of Colombia, but Colombia has really turned around as far as a tourist destination. So, you know, everything that people have heard about and that, you know, you see dramatized in TV and movies, yep, and everything, to some degree that still does exist. And I could tell you some stories about some places I've been on scouting trips, but, you know, where this camp is and where I would be comfortable bringing tourists, you know, there's really none of that to worry about. As far as the, like you said, alligators and stuff, eating dogs. Yeah, there's definitely wildlife to be worried about.
What's the worst one? What's the worst wildlife?
Probably snakes. You know, snakes are sort of an ever-present thing in these parts of the world.
Oh, right. What snake is there? I mean, there's probably a bunch, but what is the one that could maybe kill you?
The fertile ants is the one that that you worry about.
Fertile lance?
Fertile lance is okay. What it's called in English. We call it, in Spanish, they call it el X.
Okay.
And, you know, I'm not a herpetologist. I don't know too much about it, but I know, you know, a bite from one of those is pretty nasty. And if you don't get help.
Right. That's one of the things, right? Again, we don't want to paint a dim yeah. picture, but yeah, if you got a 6-hour boat ride, is there one thing? I mean, again, Alaska, you know, if you're up there that you could hit your button and a helicopter can come get you in minutes, right? Even remote, right? Is that sort of thing going on there?
Yeah. You've got the same sort of options. You know, when us bringing tourists in, we'd get the full insurance packages that, you know, the tourism it's industry offers.
Yep.
So it is all covered. You know, knock on wood, we'll never have to use it, but
yep.
you know, you'd rather have it than not.
Yeah. Well, it's a good peace of mind. You know what I mean? Because it's one of those things where, hey, if you do get bitten by this snake, which I can't even pronounce, I'd love to know that, okay, I could be out of there in enough time to get to the hospital. Right.
Yeah. But, you know, if you stick within the camps and, you know, you don't get too adventurous and go, you know, too out into the bush on your own, there's really not too much to worry about.
Yeah.
You know, I've been bouncing around the tropics now for, like I said, about 15 years, and I've seen some, but I've never had any real, you know, close encounters with anything like that.
Right. So there you go. So in 15 years, you've never really had a super close encounter.
No, it's, you know, you just gotta keep your wits about you, pay attention. Especially at night, don't go wandering into the woods.
Oh, right.
You know, stuff like that.
Yeah.
There is some other stuff. You know, there's, caimans or, you know, types of alligators and things like that, but they're really not a threat to people. So.
Today's episode is sponsored by Tressel, who has earned an exceptional reputation over the past few years in the fly fishing industry due to the popularity of their telescopic fly rod roof racks and statement-making artist series apparel lines. Their latest release for 2023 is the Jerrion Universal Bike Rack Packing System, a brand new way to transport your fly fishing and outdoor gear. The Jerrion will give any modern bike the ability to bring 30 pounds of gear with its front and rear articulated racks. Whether you ride a full suspension mountain bike, an e-bike, or even a carbon fiber road bike, the Jerrion will get you and your fishing gear further, faster, and have much more fun along the way. I can tell you this has been a big struggle for me. I've been riding my bike, both road bikes and mountain bikes, and had lots of issues over the years packing my gear, whether that's crappy storage on the back or a trailer that's just too big and bulky. So I'm excited to share this packing system, which is going to make it way more convenient and accessible to get out to the places you need to go. You can learn more about how Tressel is transforming the way you access your favorite water, backcountry hunting zones, and camping spots. Head over to wetflyswing.com/Tressel right now and be the first on the water and the farthest upstream and away from the crowds. That's Tressel, T-R-X-S-T-L-E. Tressel, live your pursuit. So on peacock bass, what does that look like? Let's start a day in the, you know, the trip. So we're getting ready to get going. We're at the camp. You know, what's our first step? When are we heading out and all that?
Yeah, well, it's a typical fishing day in a remote location. So fishing is the priority. You know, you're up super early. Colombians are amazing when it comes to hospitality. So breakfast is, you know, a big spread. As you can imagine, the coffee is great and fresh. So that's a pretty early start. You know, we like to do breakfast at around 5:30, 6 in the morning, to get everybody sort of fueled up and then in the boats as early as we can get them in the boats and then out. So try to be on the water about 6:30. And it depends on the day as to how far you run. You know, the camp situated, and there's about 25 kilometers of fishable river, both up and down. With a whole bunch of different lakes, Oxbow lakes that are off the river, and then the river itself fishes great. So, you know, it depends on what the clients want to do and what everybody's feeling on the day. But, you know, you can have a 10-minute boat ride or an hour boat ride in the morning. It's sort of up to you. And then, yeah, it's lines in. So peacocks, you know, peacocks are I like to call them every man's fish of the jungle. They're such a rewarding fish to fish for, because you know, you don't have to be, you know, an ace caster or tie the best flies or any of that. They're really, really responsive, especially out in these, you know, these remote areas. So there's a couple different ways that we target them. But the most common way is, you know, like you bass fish, just bang in the bank.
Yeah, they are bass, right?
Well, they're not actually bass. They're a cichlid, but you know, in behavior, they're very, very similar to a bass.
And in appearance, I mean, they definitely look wild, but the head, I mean, that's definitely a bass looking.
Yeah, head. Exactly. So, you know, ecologically speaking, they're very similar to a bass, just, you know, as far as the taxonomy of them, they're a completely different group of fishes. But yeah, they act very similar. They look very similar. So yeah, you know, pounding the banks in the lakes or in the river itself, just casting to fishy looking spots, whether it's deadfall or little current breaks, or, you know, you see a hump under the water, you know, of sand or something like that. They're unbelievably aggressive. You know, so just getting a fly in their vicinity usually gets some sort of response from them, whether it's them coming and charging it or just flat out destroying it and eating it, or, you know, coming to check it out. But there's, you know, there's a bunch of different ways to fish them. My favorite way to fish them is sort of on the flats, if you will. So the beach areas of the river, you know, as the river level drops in the dry season, when we're out there, you get these sort of like big extensions of flats where you can either float in the boats and fish from the boats like you would, you know, in the flats somewhere in the Caribbean or something like that, or fish from the sand, the beaches. And it's shallow enough that the dark water that you know, these rivers are made up of, you can see through it enough. You know, it's sort of a strange thing. It's a tea stained, you know, a tannin stained water, but it's still pretty clear. It's sort of, until you really see it, it's hard to describe. But so from the beaches, you get these, you know, awesome opportunities to sight fish, these fish. And in the mornings, they'll be cruising. I don't really know why, but they tend to cruise in the real shallow water. So you see these big, big, like wakes of these massive fish just cruising. And as long as you can get up in front of them and get a cast in front of them, they're usually gonna eat. Like I said, they're such a rewarding fish. And then, you know, there's other ways to fish them, deeper water. You can sort of throw sinking lines and heavy flies and dredge through it and things like that. But, you know, for the most part, it's banging the banks or indoor sight fishing on the flats of the river. But,
right. What's that fly look like that you're using if you're trying to get them more towards the top?
Fly selection is kind of up to the angler. You know, there's a lot of different stuff that works. So, you know, I personally, coming from the Northeast, I'm a flat wing guy. So I tie a lot of flat wing style bait fish. Like I said, they're such a rewarding fish that you can really throw anything.
What does a flat wing bait fish fly look like?
So a flat wing's a lot like a deceiver pattern. It's you know, it's a bucktail and
yeah, gotcha. Yeah, just your typical
and feathers.
Standard.
Yeah, yeah. You just arrange the materials a little bit different for a flat wing, and they move really well in the water, which is why I like them, and they're super easy to tie, which is another gotcha. Benefit to it.
And you're just and what are you imitating with those things?
Just small bait fish. There's, you know, there's so many different species in these rivers of smaller fish, from different cichlids to, you know, smaller catfish to all sorts of different stuff. So generic sort of patterns, green and white or chartreuse and white or the color, the go-to colors there, but, you know, yellow and white or red and yellow, bright stuff that's going to attract the fish, is mostly what we go with. But, you know, like I said, they're such a rewarding fish that you can really kind of fish whatever you want and you'll produce fish. The green and white seems to be the best combo, you know, from my experience. But, yeah, they, they love top water as well, you know, so big poppers or big gurglers or, you know, anything that, that makes a lot of noise, they're attracted to noise. So, you know, they love that sort of stuff.
Right.
So yeah, you know, I'm personally, you know, fly selection isn't the most important thing to me. It's how you fish the fly.
Yeah.
That's sort of the way I approach it. So, you know, if you're blind casting to like pound on the banks, make the fly dance, you know, make it look like a panicked little bait fish. And that seems to be the ticket with, you know, these jungle predators in general, but, you know, just making that fly look like it's about as uncomfortable as possible.
Right.
And that seems to get their hackles up and get them moving and attacking.
Yeah.
But,
One fly you might want to check. We just had a recent guest mention the jerk changer, you know, what I guess is one of Blaine's styles, you know, but it does all sorts of crazy stuff just by a normal strip, right? It's just erratic doing circles, but pretty much anything that you can make it move, you just want to make that thing go crazy, like it's kind of wounded or whatever, running.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. You know, big strips, big pauses, just, you know, make it dance. That's the thing. Yeah. And the fish respond.
The surface would be cool. I mean, the popper. So how would you do that if you're casting a popper? Are you doing the same thing, casting that towards the bank, or how are you fishing that?
Yeah. For the most part towards the bank. The poppers are fished a little bit more rhythmically, you know, making them pop, making a lot of noise, things like that. You can also just rip them across the water, and fish will react to that too. I have actually caught quite a few good size fish on poppers in the middle of lakes, which is sort of, you know, it's one of those things you're fishing and maybe in, you know, 15, 20 minutes, you haven't seen a fish or hadn't got a strike fish in the bank. So you said, well, let me just turn around and throw in the middle of the lake. And then boom, you know, you get an attack out in the deep water. You know, there's these boats when we're out there, we don't really have, you know, there's not electronics or anything like that. So you don't really know how deep it is other than, you know, sticking a stick in the water and figuring out exactly how deep it is, but they're not very deep, you know, probably 6 to 10 feet for the most part. That's sort of an average depth for these lakes. So if you're making enough noise on the top and those fish are down deep, they're going to hear it and at least look up, you know.
Right.
You always hope that they're going to come up and crash it.
Gotcha. And what are you guys fishing here? So does this describe the waterway? There's lakes and rivers, or what are you?
Yeah. So it's the river itself is a pretty low gradient, river. It's, you know, it's sort of a meandering river, lots of big bends and everything. And because of that, in this part of the world, you get, oxbow lakes. So they're lakes that used to be part of the river. And then during a flood event, it's either been isolated or however it works out. But so the river itself is a good sized river, between 20 and 40 yards wide, sort of on an average. Some parts are probably a little wider. A lot of areas are a little skinnier. And then you've got these lakes. Some of them are really, really big, you know, a mile long or longer, that are sort of set off from the main river channel. Some of them are a little tricky to get to. You got to go through some pretty tight stuff to get back in there. And then other ones are more open and you've got big openings onto the river. So, you know, like I said, the river fishes really well and the lakes fish really well. It's sort of, you know, up to the angler, what they want to do. And you know, what that week is producing, you know, if you're seeing more fish in the river, the first couple of days, then the tendency is to continue fishing the river, or vice versa. If you're seeing more fish in the lakes, you tend to focus on the lakes, but, it's a pretty, pretty diverse fishery in that sense. And then there's also, on this particular river, there's a couple, I don't want to say rapid sections, but there's a couple sections that have some good current to them. And then as you go up towards, you know, the sort of the limit of where you can get to in the boats, there's a small waterfall that's about, I don't know, 15 feet, depending on the water level, of course, but, and it's, they call it a raudal, which is just a sort of a cascade thing. And there's some fast water up there. And that's where we focus on the piata fishing, which is
which
is a whole different ball game. But you can still fish peacocks in the fast water too. Like I said, you can use some sinking line and heavier stuff and get down. And
okay, is this the El Tuparo National Park?
No.
No. Where are you from that?
We're south from there.
Yeah, you're south. Okay, so yeah. So the river pretty much kind of takes it kind of goes through, I guess, Venezuela and the Orinoco, right? And then it goes down.
Yeah.
And are you on that river where you're talking about here with all these?
No. So the Orinoco is the main river. You know, that whole.
Oh, gotcha.
The whole area we call.
That drains it all.
Yeah, Orinoquia. And then for this trip, you don't actually ever get on the Orinoco. We fly into a town called Puerto Inirida, and then you run up the Inirida River, and then later up the smaller river called Caño Bocón. So we're never actually on the Orinoco, but the Orinoco is the drainage. You know, it's that whole area, and all of the sort of smaller rivers that, you know, are known for peacock bass in Colombia and in Venezuela are tributaries of the Orinoco. They're all part of the Orinoco drainage.
Gotcha. Yeah, they're all in. That drains everything. Yeah, basically both countries, looks like it's the biggest river in that area.
Yeah, I don't know the exact stats, but it's one of the bigger rivers in South America.
Gotcha. Cool. So that's it. So you're fishing kind of some slower water, like oxbows and like what are essentially kind of like lakes, and using pretty much whatever technique you want for these peacocks. Do you out there, are you getting, ever getting tired of catching them? Is it that sort of thing? Or what are people saying there?
I have yet to have that problem, but
yeah,
but yeah, I mean, there's some days, where you can get into a lot of them. You know, going back to fly selection a little bit, I personally, fish, you know, smaller flies. Like the flat wings are probably in the 3 to 4 inch range, tied on bigger hooks, and using a smaller fly like that, you get a lot more fish, a lot of smaller fish, but you can also hook into some bigger fish too. So, you know, the size of the fly you want to throw is kind of up to, you know, what you're able to throw comfortably, you know, on whatever rod you're using. Cause you could throw, you know, a 15 inch streamer out there and get responses from big peacocks. They're just, you know, they're that aggressive. But do you want to be throwing a 12 weight and a 15 inch streamer all day?
No.
Yeah. So
yeah, not all day.
So I typically use, you know, I'll fish an 8 weight and smaller stuff. And with that smaller stuff, you know, you can get some 20, 30 fish days. You know, they're not all going to be trophies, but.
No. And you're getting a mixture of fish. So you're catching, not only you get a chance for a peacock, but on that same fly, you might catch something else.
Yeah. Yeah. There's all sorts of small stuff. And there's a couple different species of peacocks as well. There's the Tamensis, which is the sort of the famous one from that area those are the ones that get big. And then there's also the Orinoco peacock that they locally call mariposas. Which they do get big. I've never seen one that big. I've never seen one over, you know, probably 8 or 9 pounds, but, the Tamensis do get big. They'll get, like I said, there's been some caught in this river that are pushing the 30 pound mark. So they're a very, very, big aggressive predator. And then, like I said, there's a few other species, like a couple different Brycon species, that'll eat flies as well. A lot of them you'll get, you know, they'll hit, the piranha or the famous for this, they'll hit the fly and then you pull the fly back and suddenly you've got half a fly because they're, you know, they're full of teeth and
yeah,
they're like a set of scissors in the water that just chew the end of your fly off.
Right. These are the which ones are these?
Piranha or yeah. The famous piranha fish that.
Yeah. Oh yeah. 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 Piranha. Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
So that's what you have. So you actually have that species. And then what are the other kind of toothy species out there?
The other big, game fish that we're going for is the payara or the vampire fish. And those ones,
right, the vampire. Yeah.
And those ones have, you know, they've got like 3 to 4 inch, canine fangs on the front of them. It's, you know, it's such a wild fish to see. You can catch piata while you're fishing for peacocks, but with a fly rod, you kind of got to change tactics a little bit for those. And definitely put on wire leader, because if you hook into a big one of those, you're going to, you know, you don't have wire on, you're going to lose it.
Yeah.
Pretty quick. But and then, like I said, there's a couple different species of catfish. I'm not an expert on catfish, but there's the sort of the red-tailed ones, and then what a lot of people call the pintadillo, or the sort of shovel-nosed leopard-looking catfish.
God, yeah, that's thing. I mean, there's all sort. I would think, you know, at least me and probably some people would be like, well, vampire fish, peacocks, piranhas. if we were to catch those three and nothing else, that would be pretty amazing. Is that a pretty doable, you know, in that week to get into all three of those?
Definitely.
Yeah. That'd be it.
Yeah. I personally have a very complicated relationship with the piata, the vampire fish, because I've lost count of how many I've hooked, but they've all come unbuttoned for one reason or another before I've got it to hand.
Yeah. Which is maybe not a bad thing, right? I mean,
yeah. You know, having to deal with one of those boatside, or, you know, in the shallows can be pretty tricky, but, you know, I've seen plenty of them landed, and they're, you know, they're an amazing fish. They're hard to get a hook set on. And then they're one of the strongest fish I've ever fished for in fresh water. So once you've got it on, they're a big wide bodied fish. They get in the current, and, you know, they're famous for getting under snags or around rocks. And like I said, for whatever reason, it's just never worked out for me. But I've definitely had the fortune of hooking quite a few of them and everything else. But between myself and the guy I'm working with in Colombia, we've got quite a few to the boat. And like you said, you know, if you're coming down and, you know, your goal is to get a peacock, a piata, and a piranha or a piranha, they're very, very doable in a week's time.
In a week's time. So that's it. So basically, like we said, we come down, do the 5-6 hour boat ride, get to camp, hang out, get out the next day, and now you're fishing, and you got like five of those days to do. After you wrap it up, I guess, yeah, same thing. Hop in the boat, hop back out, you know, bing, bang, boom, you're back to the States, right? As far as setting this up, is that pretty standard? I mean, and somebody could connect with you to do, you know, to help set this trip up?
Yeah. It's, you know, getting to Bogota from the States is very easy. There's plenty of flights from different major airports around the country. And then, the way we operate is a full stop shop, you know, so it's a completely inclusive trip. You know, we don't expect people coming from the States to have to book their own hotels or their own internal flights or any of that sort of stuff. We take care of all that. So they pretty much just need to get to Bogota, and then, you know, it's up to them to get there a day before or a couple days before. But then early morning, we fly from Bogota to Ninirida, and all in one day, that afternoon, get in the boats and shoot up to the camp. And like you said, then there's five full days of fishing, which, you know, a lot of people that do destination fishing are used to it, but people that don't do a lot of destination fishing, you know, 5 days of fishing for 12 plus hours a day, it takes a toll. So one of those things, you know, make sure that you're ready for that sort of thing.
Yeah. The people coming down here, are they, my guess is most of them probably have lots of experience, right, behind the fly rod?
Yeah, you'd hope so. I mean, it's not one of those destinations for a first-time angler, really. Although, like I said, the peacock bass is a very, very rewarding fish. So it easily could be, you know, it's one of those things. But just because of the logistics involved and everything else, you know, it's more people with experience that want to go see a part of the world that, you know, is relatively unknown and fish in a fishery that doesn't have a lot of pressure and things like that. Yeah. Same sort of attraction as, like you're saying, as an Alaska fly out trip.
Yeah, that, same thing.
That sort of crowd.
What's that look like for you with the logistics? It sounds like you're planning a lot of this stuff. Is that quite a bit of work getting everything together? And I imagine there's some bumps along the way on all these.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, operating in this part of the world, there's always some bumps, but, you know, you just kind of take it in stride. I'm In Colombia, I'm working with a good friend of mine whose name is Andres Trujillo, who's a friend from Quito. He's Colombian, but grew up here and lived here for a long time. So we've known each other for years, but he's a very good fly fisherman, but also his profession has been a birding guide. So he's a professional tour guide for birders, which is a really big industry down here in Ecuador and Colombia. So he and I got together and started talking about, you know, this whole fly fishing thing, especially in Colombia, is an amazing thing. And there's not a whole lot of operators that focus on just the fly fishing. So he and I put this idea together. And over the past couple of years, we've done a bunch of scouting trips together and then found this particular camp. But between he and I, we take care of all the logistics. You know, he's a licensed guide in Colombia and has a, you know, travel agency, if you will. So, and he's got all the connections for us to work out the logistics of the trips with the local airlines and,
gotcha,
and everything else.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the key. You got a partner or somebody. Yeah. You're helping with all the logistics, which would be a lot if you're trying to do it on your own.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. I mean, it's, you know, like I said, doing these sort of adventures, DIY is really not for the faint of heart. And in some ways it doesn't really exist, because no matter what, getting out to these parts of the world, you know, you need support from either the local people or somebody in country just to get yourself set up. If you just, you know, as a gringo, try to fly down, even if you do speak fluent Spanish, you know, just showing up somewhere and try to get it all.
That's right.
Get it all worked out would be a,
that's right,
would be a difficult one.
Yeah. What is that? So what's a flight cost down there typically? Just, I guess you're going from Texas or somewhere easy.
It's, you know, it depends. Right now flights are pretty pricey.
They are.
Yeah. In general, the world is got a little bit crazy after the pandemic with prices and things like that. So, you know, you're looking at probably $1,000 to $1,200 for a flight. You can get them for a lot cheaper. It depends on, you know, when and where and how you set it up, but that's, you know, probably around that, maybe $800. And then our tours, like I said, it's a week. And we're charging $3,800. And that's, like I said, all inclusive. So that gets everything from the second you land in Bogota till the moment you fly out of Bogota again.
That sounds amazing. I mean, that sounds like, and again, going back to the Alaska analogy, you know, if you're to get a trip, a similar thing up there, you know, it probably costs more than that, right? To do one of those remote camps. I'm just guessing. I haven't done that exact thing, but so you got that. So basically for $5,000, I mean, your flight and the whole thing, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it's, it's a pretty, you know, pretty affordable trip. You know, the camp, like I said, is incredibly comfortable. It's nothing fancy, you know, it's glamping, great food, you know, comfortable, everything else, but it's not, you know, it's not a 4 or 5 star lodge. I don't want to paint that picture. But it is, you know, it's great. And especially people that haven't been to this part of the world, it's a great way to experience it. You know, it's a great way to see it. And, you know, you're fully immersed in not only the jungle itself, which is an experience all on its own, but this camp being owned and operated by the local indigenous group there. They're called the Puinave. You know, you're amongst all of them. It's a pretty cool experience. And, you know, they're great people. You know, people are people. So I'm sure there's some assholes in the mix, but I haven't met any yet. But they're great. They're incredibly, you know, welcoming and everything else. And they've been operating for, I think this will be their 6th, if not 7th year operating. So they've got, you know, a few years under their belt and know the deal. And, you know, it's a very communal community. You know, they share just about everything. So
today's episode is sponsored by Maverick Fly Fishing. They make the lightest Euro Nymph reel in the world, which makes your rod more sensitive, casting more accurate, and you can hold your dead drifts longer without the shoulder burn.
This reel is so unique, you may not even recognize it as a fly reel. I had a chance to fish the stinger reel with Jeff on his home river on the Truckee. The biggest thing that I remember is the weight. The weight really stuck out because you can't even barely tell there's a reel. It's essentially kind of like you're holding a rod all day long. I mean, it's that light. And when you're Euro nymphing, that is a key. And the other big thing I remember from that day was catching a fish on my first cast. Pretty cool to be down in that part of the country and have some great success with Jeff. Maverick keeps things simple by offering a Euro nymph product line with essentials you'll need from rod, reel, fly line, and leader system. Euro nymphing doesn't have to be complicated, so let Maverick Fly Fishing get you started right now. You can learn more by checking out Maverick's YouTube channel for some tips and tutorials. And you can also head over right now to wetflyswing.com/maverick to check out the good stuff they have going. That's Maverick, M-A-V-R-K, wetflyswing.com/maverick to support this podcast and take a look at one of the most unique and efficient Euro nymphing setups on the market. Okay, back to the show. You noted the photography at the start. Is that something you're doing kind of on the side, or you have a couple of photo tips to add here? What, is this more like a phone sort of thing, or are you like a pro photographer?
I'm definitely not a pro photographer, but I've been into photography for, you know, for as long as I can remember, you know, from film cameras back in, you know, however long ago that was, to digital stuff. So I'm pretty crazy. I carry a big, heavy DSLR around with me everywhere.
Yeah, you got the big thing.
Yeah, and, you know, a slew of lenses, and recently kind of got into the drone thing, which I'm still learning.
Oh, nice. Are there any drone videos or good photos you'd send us to take a look at some of these peacock bat or these trips we're talking about?
Yeah, for sure. I've got tons and tons of media, both film and video, that I can share with you guys. And you know, you can also see everything on my Instagram site or my website.
Yeah, what's the Instagram again?
It's Lane4Photography.
Oh, perfect. I'll put links out to that, and then lane4.com. Nice. Well, let's get one. Do you got one tip? Just somebody's here, maybe not a super pro, but they want to capture a better, you know, their next trip, they're out in the jungle or wherever. What would you tell them to get some good pics here?
The best recommendation that I can give you is just having your camera ready all the time.
Mm.
That's like 90% of it.
And by ready, are you with the SOR? Do you have this thing around your neck at all times, or just in a bag, just sitting there ready to pull out?
You know, I'd like to say I have it around my neck all the time, but I definitely don't. But I do keep it, you know, ready in the boat, lens cap off. If the weather looks questionable, maybe inside a dry bag, but something that's really easy to grab, and have all the settings ready to go. So, you know, if it's myself that's caught a fish, I can hand it to a friend or hand it to the guide and just say, you know, just point and shoot.
Yeah.
And, you know, have your aperture and your exposure settings to what you think is the best for that situation. And, you know, it's digital photography these days, so you don't have to be shy. You know, you just fire away, take a ton of photos. Hopefully some come out better than others. Obviously with photography, the light is a lot of it. The tropics are notoriously difficult for photography, just because the light is so harsh. So depending on the time of day, making sure that the, you know, the sun is behind the camera, illuminating the subject, not, you know, not vice versa, stuff like that. But, like I said, I'm not a pro. I'm just an enthusiast. Hopefully someday, you know, people start buying my pictures. So then I can call myself a pro, but at this point, I'm just an enthusiast.
Cool. Nice. You mentioned the scouting trip at the start story. I'm not sure if you remember what you're talking about there. You said there was a couple of good stories from, I guess, you were scouting Columbia. Was that early on?
Yeah, that was sort of pre-pandemic. And then we did one trip during the pandemic. I don't want to put any, you know, bad pictures out there of Columbia, but there's definitely some areas where, you know, you do have to be careful. And one trip we did, which was seriously a bare bones trip, you know, it wasn't anything, you know, dangerous as far as being in areas where there was questionable people operating, but, you know, just being out there, completely out there on our own, you know, probably an 8-hour drive from the nearest town. And we just literally, myself and Andreas and actually my wife and his business partner at the time, we just rented two boats and hired two guys and went out in the Los Llanos de Colombia, which are, you know, the flatlands of Eastern Colombia. And it was a wild trip. You know, we were sort of underprepared for it. At that time in that part of the country where we were, the bugs were the worst I have ever seen. So we were just, you know, sort of miserable for a week getting eaten by.
What kind of bugs?
Sand flies more than anything, but there were sand flies, mosquitoes, big horse flies. I don't know what did it on that particular river. But
did you have your head nets and all that gear?
Oh, we had everything, but still any piece of exposed skin at the end of that week was just red, you know, it was just raw.
Right.
And that trip, you know, the fishing was pretty good on that trip, but the logistics of everything and then, you know, the bugs, it sort of turned us off that destination. But just one story from that trip, we were back at camp after a day of fishing, and one of the guys that we had hired, you know, to run the boats for us, he was like, "Oh, I'm just going to shoot down river a little ways and fish for some piranha for dinner."
No.
So he takes off, and then like an hour later, it was getting dark or getting darker. He comes back walking and he was like, "I got some bad news." I'm like, "Oh, what happened?" He's like, "Well, the motor, you know, I hit a log and the motor jumped off the back of the boat and it fell into the river."
Oh, God.
We're like, "You gotta be kidding me." So for however it worked out, I couldn't explain this, but his idea was, okay, there's a road access to the river about 45 minutes upriver by boat. So we went there, and by happen chance, there was a group of people there that had masks and snorkels and hooks to go look for things in the river.
Hmm.
It was, you know, it was the luckiest thing that I can ever, you know, really, you know, I can't compare it to anything else. But anyway, so we grabbed this guy and we're like, "Can you give us a hand? We lost a motor." And he was like, "Oh yeah, yeah." So he came down and, you know, I think we gave him some snacks. I can't even remember. He wouldn't accept any money, but he was like, "Oh yeah." And it's one of these old, Yamaha Enduro 25 horsepower. So pulled it out of the river, stuck it back in the back of the boat, pulled the spark plugs out of it.
Yep.
Few pulls, cleared the water, spark plugs back in, and
there you go.
Fired up, and that was it. And there was no problems.
That's it. And is that older? I guess I wonder if you could do that to a motor these days, right? Newer.
I think, you know, Yamaha is still making that model. Yeah. It's probably a little bit more modern, but
same deal. You just kind of clear out the spark plugs. Yeah, that's true. My dad had an old Jeep Wagoneer back in the day, and he at the boat ramp, he's putting in the drift boat, and the e-brake something went out. It sunk the boat down to the bottom. Like literally, the headlights were beaming. This is in the Deschutes. The headlights were shining out of the water right early in the morning. And but they pulled that thing out, and you know, the same thing. They cleared it out, right? Did whatever, cleaned the spark plugs, and that thing drove for like 20 more years.
Yeah, man. Old technology is awesome like that.
Yeah. So I'm not sure. That's the goal. I'm not sure if these new cars, they could handle that. But nice. Well, so I guess you've had some experiences. It sounds like you've got this one dialed in pretty well now. You got the local crew. Ecuador is something we didn't dive into, but just give us a quick snippet on Ecuador. Like if somebody wanted to go there, like I said, we talked about the lodge over there, but are you doing a similar thing where it's more of a kind of river camps you're setting up there?
Yeah. Well, yes and no. It depends. So Ecuador, you know, is one of the most diverse countries in the world, especially down in this part of the world. So, you know, as far as the fishing goes, you can fish for just about anything you want. We've got, you know, the stuff in the salt from the Galapagos that you've talked about before, mm-hmm. the marlin fishing there. Then we've got great jigging for stuff off the coast here. And then there's rooster fish, actually.
Yeah, roosters.
That run the coast. And I've been trying to get those figured out on the fly. I've managed to get a couple to eat over the years, but they haven't come together. So there's that. And then there's, you know, freshwater stuff from the rivers that come down out of the mountains that go towards the coast. There's, you know, snook and corvina that live in those rivers. And then as you get further up, there's fish that are very similar to what they fish for in Central America, the machaca. And then we've actually got a river corvina that will run almost, you know, tens of kilometers in pretty high elevation up into those rivers too, which is a really unique fish that there hasn't been too many studies on. Nobody knows too much about it. And then trout in the mountains, and then the Amazon basin where we've got our own species of golden Dorado. We've got peacock bass, arapaima, of course. And, you know, there's a slew of other species in the Amazon that, you know, you can fish for. But so what I'm trying to do down here, I'm currently getting all permissions sort of squared away. Ecuador's a little bit more complicated as far as the permissions go, but we could do a whole other episode on that, so we won't delve into it.
Right.
More custom catered trips, you know, so whatever people want to do. The beauty of Ecuador is that you can do, you know, so much in such a short period of time. So if somebody wants to come down for a week or 2 weeks and fish, you know, the salt, the jungle, trout, and anything in between, you know, we can fit it all in. And that's kind of what the aim is for Ecuador, is to sort of work on the variety of fishes versus concentrating on one thing. Of course, we can cater trips to.
Yeah. But getting the whole experience, it seems to me that is the big thing about it. You go down there, you know, yeah, for sure. Like we were saying, peacocks, and you have these few species, but man, if you went down there and just didn't even get one of those, or, you know what I mean, maybe got something else, it still, I'd imagine, would be pretty amazing trip, right? Just the whole experience, that's as equal of a part as the fishing.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, Ecuador is such a visually beautiful place. Colombia is as well.
Yes. What's the difference? Ecuador, Colombia, what is the biggest difference, like, with the physical habitat out there?
The difference is the size. I mean, Colombia is a huge, huge country. I don't even know what to compare it to, you know, as far as other countries or land masses, but it's probably five times the size of Ecuador. You know, it's really, really big.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, the distances involved in fishing a lot of the different parts of Colombia, because Colombia has great variety as well, but the logistics and distances are massive. So it's not a very convenient thing to do, you know, in a short trip. Colombia's also got excellent saltwater fishing, and then Bahia Solano. I've personally never been there, but my business partner's been there a bunch, and I know a lot of people that have fished there, and they just say it's like the holy grail of saltwater fishing. It's just this undisturbed, you know, beautiful coastal ecosystem where you've got, you know, marlin to roosters to everything in between. So there's a lot of good saltwater fishing and variety of fishing in Colombia, but it's such a big country that the logistics of doing it in a short period are complicated. Where Ecuador, you know, if you fly into Quito, everything's close. You know, everything's a couple hour drive, or, you know, we can arrange flights that are, you know, 30 minutes to 45 minutes to get to the different areas and things like that. So it's all very, very, very accessible. And that's the, you know, the really unique thing about Ecuador is being able to access so much in a short amount of time in a small country.
Yeah. Right. Cause you're right there. Yeah. You're in the Quito is like right on the west side of the mountains, but you could probably hop on and go towards the ocean or the other side. Right. But, Colombia is gigantic. I mean, just roughly, I'm just looking at a map. I mean, it's bigger than Texas, but it might be similar to the size of Texas, right?
Yeah. Something like that. I mean, you know, to put it in perspective, if you were able to drive to some of the places that were going for peacocks, you know, it would take 2 to 3 days.
Oh, wow.
From Bogota.
Oh, what?
Yeah. So it's far.
But you're not able to really, the road system isn't, you can't do a lot of this stuff by road.
No, where the place I've been describing, Kenya Bokong, is not accessible by road at all. And even Inirida, where we fly into, is not accessible by road from Bogota. There's probably some road systems, you know, remote road systems that get there from other big towns. sort of on the Orinoco. I'm not familiar with it enough, but for the most part, it's a port town on the river with an airport. And then some of the other areas in the northern part of eastern Colombia, there's a town called Puerto Careño, which is where a lot of sport fishing, you know, a lot of peacock bass fishing sort of logistics operate through there. That is accessible by road, but that, you know, it's a couple days drive from Bogota or from Medellin, which is another, you know, one of the main
main cities. Yeah. On the peacocks, I guess just taken out of here with peacock bass. So, you know, again, there's all these other species. As far as like resources or, you know, like how have you learned? Have you kind of like just done the Google search? Are there other resources? If somebody wanted to dig in a little bit deeper to find out, okay, what something we didn't cover today about these, this species or others, where would you send them?
Yeah. I mean, the internet these days, like you said, Google is a great resource. Obviously you need to filter through a lot of it. But there's a ton of information available, you know, online, YouTube videos, et cetera, et cetera. Like I said, there's a pretty big network of people that are fishing and operating in Colombia. So there's a lot of information on peacock bass fishing there. Brazil's been a traditional place for peacock bass fishing for years. So there's a ton of information available.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And because, you know, there's peacock bass available sort of in some unique isolated places in the U.S. And around the world as well. But in South Florida, you know, peacock bass have been introduced. So there's quite a bit of literature on peacock bass fishing from that, you know, in English and accessible to most, you know, most Americans or most English speaking people. I believe they've been introduced to Hawaii as well and a few lakes out there. So
there you go.
Yeah, there's a lot of resources. I've been lucky enough that, you know, being down here, I've just kind of get thrown into it and figured a lot of it out on my own, I would say. You know, I've definitely not been doing this in a vacuum. There's been other people involved and there's a lot of other influences on what I'm doing and how I'm doing it. But yeah, the peacock bass fishing, particularly in Ecuador, you know, there's really not a lot of information and there's not a lot of accessible information on any of it. But going back to what I said, you know, before, peacock bass are such a great fish because they're so responsive to flies or to lures or, you know, to whatever you're throwing out there, that they're a fairly easy fish to figure out if you can just get to where they're at.
Yeah.
You know, they're very rewarding. They're very, very accepting, I guess is the turret of flies and artificials. So they're a great fish to fish for.
We'll leave it at that, and we'll send everybody out, like we said, lane4.com if they want to follow up with you and or check out some of your stuff on Instagram. And this sounds like a pretty amazing trip. I definitely would love to get down there, and hopefully we'll keep in touch with you and see how it all looks. But thanks for all the time today, Lane.
Yeah, much appreciated. It's my pleasure.
So there it is, wetflyswing.com/410. 410. It's the best place to go and follow up on this episode, find out and dig into some of the resources we connected with, maybe check out a video or two and see what else we have going at our blog. Quick listeners shout out before we get out of here. Tim Miller, Tim from Sonora, California. Want to thank Tim for supporting this podcast and for being a listener. And if you want to get a quick shout out on this podcast anytime, you can just connect with me. Send me an email. That's the best way. And let me know what podcast episodes you're liking or maybe what you'd like to hear. Quick and easy way, dave@wetflyswing.com. Hope to hear from you soon. Quick reminder, next week we're launching into the Euro Nymphing giveaway event. This is going to be our chance to share some of the resources and give you a chance to win this magical trip over to fish one of the great rivers and learn from some of the greatest Euro nymphers in this country. We're going to have a whole week on digging into some of that content. So if you've been excited to learn more about it, find out what we have going, you can check that out right now next week. Stay tuned for that. All right, if you haven't connected with me, it's time. If we haven't talked before, give a quick shout out on social or send me an email anytime.
And I am going to get out of here. It is not late, not super late yet, but I am going to wish you a good evening, a good morning, or good afternoon, wherever you're coming from in the world. Look forward to talking to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show. For notes and links from this episode, visit wetflyswing.com.